everyone. This is Sean T. Collins. I write the A Song of Ice and Fire blog, All Leather Must Be Boiled, at boiledleather.com, and I am one of the co-authors of the annotated A Game of Thrones for subtext.com. And joining me once again
is Stefan Sasse. I am the essayist of The Tower of the Hand, or better, one of the essayists of The Tower of the Hand. I also wrote the blog of a reread of Dance with Dragons and contribute random stuff to any other Song of Ice and Fire related sites. So, today we are going to explore some issues following up our last two podcasts, exploring Honor in Westeros and Good Rulers and Reform in Westeros. And our first topic today will be, is Westeros a warrior society or an aristocratic society? And I am really proud of myself for pronouncing aristocratic right. So, let's go into that. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I'm really curious to hear what your point of view is on this, Stefan. It seems to be sort of your area of expertise, and, you know, so...
Now you're flattering me. Okay, I think it is in truth both, but regionally with other priorities. Some regions are more into the warrior society aspect, relying heavily on the knights and the knight honor code. One could think of the Westerlands, not of the Westerlands, of the Stormlands, for example. Partially also the Reach. The North is a very much a warrior society, while other seven kingdoms are more aristocratic societies, like the Westlands, the Riverlands, for example, the area of King's Landing. It's more of a question where you put the emphasis on. You have both elements, but one of them always prevails and creates these effects that change directions and form the directions leaders take.
One thing that we had talked about briefly during one of our last discussions is how prowess in battle is one of the few vectors for social advancement available to people in Westeros. And I'm wondering how you think that plays out in terms of the balance of power between the aristocratic element of society and the warrior, knight, battle-driven aspect of society. Because obviously, lords are expected to be successful when their regents go to war. How much do you think that drives the decisions that are actually made by people all up and down the scale of power, from the top, you know, to the lowliest knights and hedge knights and sellswords and things? Do you think that phenomenon has an impact on the fabric of society in terms of that sort of weighing those two roles of the sort of aristocratic nobles versus the warlords?
I think the social movement, the social flexibility that one can, when he fights well, he can join the ranks of the knights and thereby be equal to other aristocrats, is more or less a myth, something like a legend that is always there, that helps to keep the society together, but that really doesn't play a large role in reality, because there are very few upstarts that become knights on the battlefield and then play a major role. Normally they are all scions from houses, lesser houses most of the time, but yeah, we seldom hear of knights who really are not nobles. It doesn't matter how low these nobles are, but knights who are upstart, like Bronn, for example, they will never get any recognition at all in the social arena of Westeros, because their families are not honor-worthy, or they are not noble enough. We can even see this with the phrase, they are a noble family for almost 700 years and still regarded as upstarts by many other families. They always say, oh, they're not so noble, you can't go to their weddings, their wives are not suitable for you, even if you are a really impoverished and a meager house. That doesn't really matter, it's the honor that wins over these arguments all the time.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, I could see that as sort of functioning similarly to here in America. We have the American dream, quote unquote. The, you know, if you work hard and play by the rules, you know, you can advance and become. Everyone has a shot at becoming rich, basically. Which, you know, as we've seen in the West, America actually has at this point one of the lowest degrees of social mobility of any of the sort of developed countries, you know, here or in Europe. So there's an extent to which that dream is sort of held out like a carrot in front of people to keep the system running smoothly, but it doesn't actually pan out.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And you have always this problem that there are very few exceptions to the rule which you can point at to say, oh, look at this guy, he made it, I don't know, Andrew Carnegie or guys like that who have started with nothing and then became rich, or in Westerosi terms, who then became famous knights. But they are very few, and even they never can get past their own family, their manners. They are simply not aristocratic because it takes more or less a lifetime of being accustomed to the style, the manner of speaking, the table manners, the etiquette, and all these other things that make up an aristocrat. And you can't just join them. And it's the same thing today, basically, but to a different degree, of course. But that's a major problem that you always will hit in Westeros if you try to go up. But that's also based firmly in history. If you think, for example, the legends of the Trojan Wars, that's also a very much a warrior society that is painted out there. But all the heroes esteem from aristocratic families, from Achilles to Hector, and they are sons of kings or stuff like that. They are never someone risen up from the rank and file.
So do you see that Westeros, do you think Westeros is approaching a tipping point where, as this war progresses and things get progressively worse, the warrior elements of society will cease being sort of a weapon used by the aristocrats and sort of end up calling the shots themselves?
I don't think so, really, because while the war certainly distorts some of the myths, like the good knight, the lords protecting the small folk, all that goes right out the window. But the backlash growing in Westeros itself, mainly in form of the stronger growing faith, doesn't exactly propose an alternative, but tries more or less to bring them back into this idea. They are very conservative to a certain point, and they try to raise an awareness for the duties of a lord, for the duties of a knight, but they do not exactly come with a revolutionary agenda. That's very much Daenerys, but she is yet to come to Westeros. In Westeros itself, we have no alternative to the present system. The people are definitely unsatisfied with it, but they don't have the idea of with what they could substitute it. And there's no other idea that could prevail. There is no idea for a war of ideas, for a competition of ideas.
Yeah, you know, the reason I brought it up is that I think as the stage we're about to enter in the Winds of Winter, I think the warring parties that seem to have the most power or influence are sort of there. We're moving away a bit from the sort of aristocratic regions, and you'll see, you know, the Ironmen attacking the Reach up north. A great deal of the manpower is commanded by the, you know, sort of the more rustic groups like the Wolves and the Norries and the Flints. You know, I'm just curious, as things go on and the center of gravity moves away from the Tullys, the Lannisters, you know, the Tyrells, will we see things play out with less control by the sort of more highfalutin elements of society. But I think you're probably right. And in the end, just for want of any other way to do things, it will revert back to the way it's been, unless someone like Daenerys comes in and truly upsets the whole system.
Yeah, I think what we witness, especially in Dance with Dragons and in the now published spoiler chapter, is more or less an exhaustion and a fatigue within the noble families, because many of them have come up on the wrong side at one point during the conflict. Some mm-hmm. were wiped out entirely, so there is room there are vacuums created that need to be filled somehow, so other families and other nobles come in, and they are necessarily lower than the people holding positions before. Just look at Stannis's guys, as this Sir Justin Massey, of whom you have never heard, or his family, and other guys like that, this Patrick of the Bleeding Star guy, whatever. There are many such people beginning to rise within the society, but they are not changing its foundation. They are just exchanging names because there is an opportunity for it.
Yeah, that's pretty much dead on. You could conceive of a resolution to this war. Certainly, the people, we may not be able to, because we are readers of fiction and we understand how these things work. But it's conceivable to imagine a resolution to this war where there are no more Boltons, no more Starks, no more Karstarks, perhaps no more Baratheons. A lot of the higher-ranking nobles throughout the Seven Kingdoms will pretty much be no more, or could pretty much be no more. But you're right, then just the next level will come in. People who ended up on the right side of the battle will take their place, which is what happened before when certain families rose to higher prominence following the overthrow of King Aerys, and or duels between the Targaryens and the Blackfyres. These things have happened before. My only question is, it seems like this war is going further than any other ones because of the approaching winter and the amount of parties involved and variables that the actual warring parties aren't aware of yet, like the Others and Daenerys, and so we'll see. We'll see exactly how far things go, I suppose.
Yeah, I also think that we, when exploring the question whether we have a warrior society or an aristocratic society, is that the warrior thing plays in a large part of being an aristocrat. There is not really a way of being 100% noble within the Westerosi society if you can't swing a sword, if you haven't won any victory. It's this prevailing problem, for example, for Mace Tyrell, who has never won a major victory that is acknowledged, really. It is a major problem for people like Littlefinger, who never ever has fought in a real conflict. And this is a sort of predicament that drives warfare, because whoever wants to rise to power, to become a king, he needs to win at least one battle. And so war will always happen within the society, if it is just to make a name out of yourself. You can see this with Renly as a prime example, because it's done brilliantly in the TV show. In this dialogue with Loras Tyrell, when Loras tells him that he needs to see blood, that he needs to fight, if only to prove that he is as capable a warrior as Robert. And the people, they don't really need to fight within their rules, but most of the time to set up their rule, or to prove at one point during their rule that they are capable of fighting. It is just a thing like today you have to prove that you are capable of winning an election. So back in these times, you had to prove that you are capable of swinging a sword at someone.
Right. And that's another way that the system incentivizes war, and to its detriment. We've seen that Robert, despite being a pretty impressive warrior, or one of the most impressive warriors that anyone had seen, to hear everybody tell it, ended up being a pretty lousy king, because he was better suited to kill than to rule.
Yeah, exactly. It is interesting that you bring up Robert, because this could lead to another of the topics we want to do today. It's this, to serve the realm, what truly constitutes the best interest of Westeros, and have any characters truly worked with that in mind? Because we always hear that Robert was a great fighter, but a more or less lousy ruler. But we have 15 years of peace, if you count out the Greyjoy Rebellion, for which Robert really isn't responsible. 15 years of peace, and then other kings, which are regarded as good or great kings, who really fought many wars in their time. Even Aemon the Fifth, Aegon, not Aemon. Mm-hmm. The Unlikely did fight a war, if I recall correctly, and or several wars. And so it is really questionable whether Robert really is such a bad king in that regard. Yes, I mean, he piles up much credits and debts and stuff, but the realm itself prospers more or less under his rule. It's this benign neglect that he brings upon the whole of Westeros. Of course, you can argue that it creates more more problems that at some point have to explode the growing Lannister power and stuff, but I'm really not sure whether there is an automatic war at the end of this, or just a shift of power that can also go over peacefully.
Yeah, I mean, I do think some blame needs to be laid at Robert's feet, to talk about Robert specifically, and you brought up the debt that he ran up. That, to me, seems pretty important. And it is perhaps only because we haven't really seen the situation with the Iron Bank play to its fullest extent just yet that we don't realize how important it is. But it's not like he was spending all this money on anything particularly worthwhile. He was pissing it away, basically, on tournaments and banquets and, you know, frivolous junk that wasn't going to benefit. You know, he was taking advantage of it being summer, I think. You know, he was a summer king in much the same way that Renly's forces were the Knights of Summer. They hadn't really been put to the test and had, you know, and I think we're sort of reaping what he sowed there by not preparing the realm in any way for the coming hardships, whether it's saving that money so that they have money to spend, or whether it's sort of tamping down on the more politically ambitious negative forces under his rule, like the Lannisters, and things of that nature. So, you know, I do think some blame needs to be laid at Robert's feet. At the same time, though, Robert was being consistently undermined, as we learn, by various members of his court, including one in the person of Varys, who claimed and seems to believe that he was there for the good of the realm. That's what he was working for. And for a long time I was inclined to believe him, because when he first expressed that, it didn't seem like it was really to his benefit to lie. And also I just think I was kind of enamored of the idea that this sleazy guy, the spymaster, the person with his fingers in every plot, was in the end good-hearted in some way.
Yeah,
but at least he has a really twisted idea of what the good of the realm means, and it's sort of like the saying, you can't make an omelet without breaking some eggs. Well, he's willing to break a whole lot of eggs to bring about some future ideal state that a lot of people have to die to bring about. You know, so Robert was in over his head without knowing it, I think, because he had people like Varys and then also like Littlefinger setting their own plots in motion.
Yeah, definitely. I think we can't discuss Varys if we do not take at face value what he says. That on the one hand, he has the best interest of the realm in mind, and that on the other hand, his main plot is about to bring a king into power who was groomed for it in a manner of an enlightened monarch. I think that fits it. If we want to discuss his best of the realm, we have to accept these two premises. They don't have to be true, but it's the only thing we can work with. So I suggest that we just do this and believe him in these two goals, and think about if that would be in the best interest of Westeros as a whole, not only for the society and what constitutes this society, but also for the very small folk people living in the realm. So, what do you think?
Well, as with many issues in these books, it boils down to a question of whether the ends justify the means. I think that Varys and Illyrio, in training a person to be king from a very young age, and by training, not just telling them, oh, hey, you deserve it, you've been born that way, you know, you'll have to be a good ruler, but like really, you know, educating him, as you said, to be this enlightened dictator. In theory, at least, that's a pretty good idea. And, you know, you may end up with rulers who just have a different set of priorities in mind and are using a different set of criteria on which they base their actions as rulers. That will be for the best in the long run. And I think that if there were a bloodless way to reconstitute the system, to create that kind of person, that would be all for the good, you know, rather than a Robert who seizes, you know, the kingdom by force, you know, really out of personal grudges, more or less, or a Joffrey who, well, it's mine, you know, I can do what I want, you know, or even just sort of someone where it's like a 50-50 shot how they're going to turn out. You know, he has a decent idea. But I can't help but think, like, well, wouldn't he have been better off just sort of pushing Robert in that direction? Certainly people would have been better off, because he wouldn't have orchestrated this ruinous war that killed however many untold thousands of people. You know, and I think he became so fixated on this idea for whatever reason. You know, I tend to give credence to the idea that he and Illyrio have a more personal stake in their Mummer's Dragon here than, you know, is perhaps apparent right now. But for whatever reason, he got so fixated on this idea of creating this new king that, for the good of the realm, that he's bleeding the realm dry to get there. And as is the case in many other situations, like Daenerys having to do what she does to create a slave-free society. That's another example that we've discussed recently. You have to ask yourself what balance you're okay with between the goal and what needs to be done to arrive at that goal. And in Varys' case, I'm pretty firmly against it at this point. I think that it's clear that there are a lot of other things he could have done to better the realm. Instead, he chose this particular plot on behalf of himself and his friend that they stand to benefit from the most. You know, untold numbers of people will die because of this decision. And, you know, I don't think you can divorce that from however noble his ideas about raising his young king might have been. You know, you can't separate that person from all the things done to put that person in power.
I also don't understand one thing about Varys' plot in general, because does he want to strengthen centralized power in the hands of a Targaryen king and wrestle power from his vassals to create more something resembling a modern state, or does he want to divide powers more equally to strengthen perhaps the kingdoms and to institutionalize some very early form of checks and balances? I'm, on the first hand, not sure what his goal is, and on the second hand, I don't know which of these two scenarios is better for the people in Westeros, because even if Varys does get his enlightened king, his a benevolent ruler who is well-educated, who is intelligent, who is compassionate, and all that, who really is larger than life in any aspect, at some point, this ruler will die, and someone has to succeed him. And this someone can never ever be that great. And how do you ensure that the successor is not the next Joffrey? I mean, right. It's the same thing imagining the realm of Gondor after Aragorn's death, for example. Because, yeah, okay, we can accept that this guy is really the one thing, but there is a point where he will die. And what happens then? I don't think that Varys, or anyone else for that matter, ever addressed that. Even Dany, who has a real issue with that, because she is prophesied to be barren, doesn't ever think about the possibility.
Yeah, if I recall correctly, Tolkien briefly considered writing a sequel to The Lord of the Rings that would have taken place during the reign of Aragorn's son, or something to that effect, and it would have involved, you know, the problems of hanging on to this kingdom that Aragorn had finally united and sort of revived. So it's funny that you should bring that up, because even Tolkien thought of that problem. Yeah, and I don't know why Varys hasn't thought that through, or if he has, what his answer for it is. You know, but I think it's pretty clear that whatever his answer and whatever he's thought of, it's not sufficient to justify all these assassinations and plots and betrayals and undermining of, you know, what ruling structure the kingdoms had to keep them from being at each other's throats. You know, Varys pushed things in that direction for whatever reason. And that blood's on his hands, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, definitely. So, to return to the question, what is in the best interest of Westeros, I would go as far as to say that for about the 99% of Westeros, the best interest would be that war is avoided at nearly all cost, that the lords and the king make sufficient preparations for storages for winter, and that perhaps there are more or less a libertarian attitude towards the rest of ruling, so that government, as meekly as it exists in Westeros, does not interfere too much with them. Low taxes and get the hell out of my parish or whatever. You know what I mean? So that they mostly do their own thing and do it quietly. It's more or less what Bolton says, with this quiet land, quiet rule. I think that is most likely what most of the people want, and it is in total contradiction to what the aristocracy needs to do, because they need to spend much money for status things. They need to wage war for status, and gaining status is all their life is about. So the objectives of the 1% really contradict and are in opposition to the objectives of the 99%. And so I think the best ruler for most people in Westeros would be a very bad ruler, or maybe even the worst ruler for the people we usually experience the story through. So yeah. That's why I say Robert Baratheon was more or less a good ruler for most of the people in Westeros, but he was a bad ruler for those who want part in the economic life of Westeros, who want a part in honor and war and stuff, because he really falls short. He's not exactly bringing the realm forward in political terms, but the small folk isn't interested in that.
Yeah, I feel as though if Robert had had a stronger hand or someone to sort of push him in the direction of more, you know, being less profligate with the funds of the nation and sort of paying a little bit more attention to the business of ruling, he actually would have been probably an excellent king, because as people have pointed out to us time and time again and throughout the books, he did not hold grudges, except for the Targaryens. That's an exception, and an important one. But in general, you know, if he fought with you, he would eventually forgive you if you bent the knee, or even if he just sort of got over it, depending on how severe the falling out was. And that's a quality that I think is important for the good of the realm, because I'm reminded of one of the things that you said in our earlier discussion, which is that for most of the small folk, any interaction with government in the person of the aristocracy is going to be bad, because they're coming to collect money, they're coming to collect levies for a war, or they're coming to kill you. for, in battle or in the form of the king's justice. So you want that interaction minimized. And that, I think, is where you're correct in saying that for the small folk, you know, a noble who's basically hands-off is good. And Robert's forgiveness and his capacity to incorporate former enemies as friends is obviously really good for the small folk, because that means wars end quicker. It means you're not going to have these sort of extermination campaigns against the influence of a particular family. I think it's really easy to conceive of a ruler who, when faced with the Greyjoy Rebellion, destroyed the Iron Islands, completely wiped out that system, because it's a system that was going to be a problem time and time again just based on the way they lived their lives. But Robert wasn't that kind of person. So if you're just the average person living on the Iron Islands, Robert's a great ruler. If you're a person in the Reach who sided against him at first, Robert's a great ruler. You want that interaction with your ruler to be minimal and bloodless. And in that sense, you know, Robert was perhaps better than a lot of people give him credit for. You're right.
Yeah, I also think that when we are talking about a good ruler and the best interest of Westeros, we have the problem that the technological level on which Westeros is founded, this medieval setting, it doesn't mm-hmm. allow for things that we would normally see as good political reforms, things
right.
as creating a welfare state or an educational system deserving the name. You simply can't do that with the resources that Westeros and its structures offer. You don't have a chance. There is no big trade, because the streets are a catastrophe. You don't have a diversified economy. You don't have consumer goods. You can't teach people much stuff. Messages take forever to reach someone. And so I think being a good ruler is mainly to do not much ruling at all that affects the life of people very much.
And that's something I'm sorry, go ahead.
Perfect. Bring your thing.
That's something that I was going to bring up when you suggested that a sort of libertarian viewpoint was the way to go. Because normally in everyday life today, I would say to you, well, libertarianism ultimately redounds to the benefit of whoever already has the most stuff, because they're best off if no one interferes with them at all. Whereas the poor, you know, that's not going to help them very much, because it's like, oh, great, leave me alone with my inadequate resources, my inadequate housing, healthcare, education, my problems with law enforcement either being insufficient to actually protect me from criminals or overbearing and sort of becoming criminalized itself. You know, that's the problem with libertarianism. However,
absolutely,
with in this system, this is again is something we discussed in one of our earlier segments. It's not flexible. There's no way for you as the small folk, beyond sort of isolated incidents where you can bring your grievances to court and maybe someone decides to do something about it, and even then it can be really arbitrary or, you know, made on the spur of the moment, as we've seen with Daenerys. There's no opportunity for you to influence your rulers back. It's an inflexible system. So since you can't push for the social welfare programs of the sort that you and I know would sort of be better off for them in the long run, then you need to think of, okay, well, what's the least worst option in light of that fact? And then you're right, I think it's the sort of more standoffish rulers, you're better off with them, because they don't have the resources to provide these things because of the way the system works, that most of the money just will remain concentrated in their own hands to maintain their power versus other families. And you don't have a political system that would even make it possible if those resources were there, beyond you know, just whatever was done at the largesse and the whim of a ruler, because there's no way for the small folk to influence their rulers in any kind of systemic fashion, because it's not a flexible system like that. It's a rigid, inflexible system, and that has all sorts of problems of its own, as we've seen. So yeah, you know, I think, well, you and I might look at the system in all sorts of ways. I mean, let's not forget that this is, you know, a monarchy and an aristocracy and a feudal system that, as a species almost, we've decided is not the right way to go. But this being a fantasy novel set in the kind of time period it is, we take certain things for granted about how the world is going to work, and in that light, then we make decisions and we make judgment calls about, you know, what, okay, if that's going to be the case, then how to proceed, you know.
Okay, I think the best way to proceed for us is to to delve into the next, because it is still related. Who are the best and worst rulers we've encountered? And I think we should take best and worst in this case in both directions. The best and worst of the definitions we just made up as a contemporary viewer of the society, and as well as one of the eyes of a Westerosi noble. And I would say that the worst rulers we've encountered so far in the mindset we just made, our just a contemporary, would be people like the young dragon, Darren II, I think it was. This guy who with 14 years set out with tens of thousands of soldiers to conquer Dorne for really no other reason than because he could, and because he wanted to make a name, and he didn't create something that lasted for longer than 4 years. Mm-hmm. And many people, including John in the books, would see him as a great ruler, as a great example for things you can achieve, for energy and being vital and bringing honor to your house and stuff like that. So I think that's the best and worst in these regards. And one of the good rulers from our view would be, unlikely as it seems, Lysa Arryn, because she doesn't care for anything that has to do with the war. For her, this whole honor thing about taking part, for example, Bros John Royce, who tries to force her to side with the Stark and Tully cause, and to take part in the war, it doesn't concern her at all. She has no idea for this honor thing. She just wants to stay out of the war, and I think the people of the Vale are very happy for it. And so we have this category, and the worst ruler, of course, is Robert Baratheon in that mindset, because he didn't do much things right that Westerosi nobles regard as right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know... So yeah, I guess I would say he hasn't really had a chance to rule just yet. I think Ramsay Bolton, if he gets the chance to call the shots himself, will be an unmitigated disaster, because he's crazy and bloodthirsty and vindictive, cruel, sociopathic, just about any word that you can say. Oh, and I don't think he'll benefit anybody. I think maybe if you're in his very small coterie of like-minded killers... You'll do all right, as we've seen with sort of his people he hangs out with who go out raping with him. But I think he's a rare case where he will be bad for both the nobility and the small folk. You know, so he's sort of almost like as opposed to someone like the young dragon, who's held up as an ideal by people with that sort of idealistic view of what nobility means and what it means to rule. But slightly more canny observers will look at him and say, well, you know, he achieved not much except, you know, sort of, you know, very fleeting glory at the expense of thousands of lives and wasted money and wasted time and wasted treasure and wasted energy. You know, a guy like Ramsay's not going to be held up as an ideal by anybody.
Yeah, that's right. He's just so evil, you forget about him. He's so the obvious choice of a bad ruler that I just didn't think of him. He's so evil, he could be the poster boy of evil.
Maybe I'm cheating. You know, as for who I would say is a good ruler, I would agree with you about Lysa Arryn. And again, that's ironic because we know that she's doing what she's doing basically because she's been told to by Littlefinger, who has plans of his own.
And because she's paranoid.
Right, and you know, she obviously has mental problems, and but it would be, of all the places I could live during the events of these books, I would want to live in the Vale because I'm not going to get killed there, chances are.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, now how that will leave her people in the future, if and when the Vale does get dragged into war, how the other warring parties will look at them and treat them accordingly. You know, that's a good question. And I think that sort of points to how you almost have to take sides and just hope that you get it right. Because the consequences of choosing the wrong side or refusing to choose can be very severe. And I wouldn't be surprised to see them punished in some way if depending on who comes out on top, I could see them being less than pleased with the Vale for not taking sides.
I don't think that the Vale will encounter such a big problem with it, because in the minds of many people, there is already a winning side with the Lannisters, and they basically did not very much mind the Vale not taking sides. They sent Littlefinger there to marry Lysa Arryn, but most of the time, I think they were simply glad that the Vale stayed neutral throughout the conflict.
Yeah, that's true. Although I wonder what a triumphant Cersei Lannister will have to say about them for not getting involved. You know, and there's another case of a bad ruler that I think everyone agrees is a bad ruler.
Yeah, in every regard.
So it is possible by dint of being mentally ill or just sort of extravagantly cruel to unite the 1% and the 99% in opposition to your conduct as a ruler. You know, I think you're right in looking for those more interesting cases where these two viewpoints are in opposition. You know, because I think that's where we learn the most about how the society works, or whether it works, you know, in cases like Lysa on the one hand and the Young Dragon on the other. Where there's this disconnect between what might go in the storybooks that the children are read and what will benefit the average farmer or even the average warrior.
Yeah, it's a very hard question to resolve because the measurements are so different of the people in the books or on the people reading the books, and there again you have to differentiate between small folk and nobles, nobles from here, nobles from there. It is always a matter of perspective, and that's what makes these books so really great, because you can have these different perspectives. It's in very few works of literature that you can really never be sure, that you always have to think which perspective I am getting here, which perspective I should take on the matter, and so on. It's really not easy, and that's what makes it such a compelling read, at least for me.
Yeah. And, you know, we, in discussing who the best and worst rulers are, we haven't even brought up the people that we spent most of our last discussion talking about, John and Danny, despite the fact that for a reader like yourself or myself, they are moving their societies for which they are responsible in the direction that is more amenable to our views of how society will work. You know, by ending slavery and attempting to institute some form of equality in that regard, whether you're talking about Danny or whether you're talking about John, and bringing the wildlings into the body politic of Westeros instead of rejecting them as sort of subhuman people that we don't need to care about, and realizing that we're all human, you know, we all have common interests, and pushing very hard against a very rigid system to enable it to incorporate them. We haven't even discussed them as best or worst, because I think it's so hard to say how that's going to play out in the end, even though you and I might root for what their goals are and what they're trying to achieve.
Yeah, definitely. That's the same thing I would say. It's very hard to see where they are going, what utopia are in their minds, what will they achieve, what are the means with which they want to achieve it. I think when we discuss this question of good and bad rulers, we should stick with those we can actually assess, those we have seen ruling, and either succeeding or failing in what they do. That's really a difficult thing with people that are still in power. You can see it in contemporary politics too. It is a really hard thing to speak about whether Obama has failed or not. It's simply not clear yet. You can argue for both sides, and it's the same thing with John and Danny. You simply don't know where it will end. But with other rulers, we have already seen where it ends, and we should perhaps take them for example, also because they are more in line with the rest of Westerosi society. John and Danny, they are just no examples. They are exceptions from rules, and we are talking more about the rules here, not the exceptions. Okay.
And there, I think the other difference is that it's easy for us to evaluate. Well, I'm trying to think of how best to put this. I guess the question is this. Do you think you're better off under... Well, that's not the right way to put it. As a reader, we bring certain questions and desires to the table that are different from if we were a character within this world. You know, I think that's very clear.
Yes.
And, you know, whereas if we're putting ourselves directly in the mindset of a member of the small folk, we would want to live under one of the Westerosi aristocrats that presides basically over a peaceful, prosperous area. You or I, as readers of the book, might rank John or Danny higher because of what they're trying to do. And although, like we discussed earlier with Varys, we need to consider the means by which they try to achieve these ends, it's important enough to us as readers to see these sort of new, more freer, more equal, less brutal societies be created that, you know, I personally feel much more passion and emotional support for Danny and John than I do for Elisa Aaron, for example. And that's quite aside from the fact that they're main characters and she isn't, and they're basically pleasant people and she's not. You know, I read what they're trying to do, and I don't think to myself, oh, well, they'd be better off just keeping the status quo and you know, being harsh to their enemies and kind to their friends and blah, 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 blah. You know, I don't think that ever when I read their, you know, I want them to succeed. I want those reforms to stick.
Yeah, it's a very human thing, I guess. Yeah. Because you have it in every human when he or she looks at an issue. You always have this spot in your heart for people that are reaching to the stars, that are doing quote-unquote great stuff, you know. It doesn't really matter whether these people succeed or what cost and this causes, what suffering results from it, as long as it is a great undertaking. You can still get people with this today. It is harder than it was before, but only so because media and stuff allows us to see more directly what it causes. But still you have this feeling, this prevailing emotion for stuff like that. You can always get people when you aim high, when you aim very high. That's why people in election years always promise so much, because it is better to reach out and then to fail than to never try at all. And I think it is the same in Westeros too. You just try, set yourself high goals, and then you root for these people. We never actually come to love rulers who say, I want to keep my land out of the war and my small folk prosperous. We can say it is a respectable aim, we can respect them for it, but we never love them for it. And I think it is the same with John and Danny. They aim very high, they do things no one has ever done before, and that is a good part of why we root for them.
Yeah, and you know, here, and this may be, I don't know, I hope I'm not transitioning prematurely, but this may be, you know, a good entrance point to one of our other topics that we wanted to bring up, which is, you know, are we wrong to sort of bring our 21st century values to this fantasy medieval type world when we read about it? And John and Danny, I think, are the most important cases of how that would work. And, you know, I think the distinction that you need to make is that, well, you need to keep in mind what their situation is. You need to keep in mind, like, well, this is the world they were raised in. So realistically, they're only going to take things so far, or they're not even going to consider certain things that are very important to us, and that's fine. The danger, I think, is completely abandoning our values and assuming the sort of viewpoint of the characters in the world in terms of what's right, and because that's where you're led to people who support Tywin Lannister and Roose Bolton as sort of ideals of leadership, because you know, like, oh well, George R. R. Martin has written this sort of harsh fantasy world that does away with a lot of the fairy tale aspects of it, and it shows how terrible life would be, so therefore you sort of need to become terrible. And I don't think we're ever supposed to do that, because I think the reason he I think he made it a terrible world not because it would be, you know, 400 times more awesome and badass that way, but to make a moral point. And so I think you need to bring your sort of moral framework to the table when you read. Now that's not to say that you then, you know, hold all characters at fault for failing to be sort of social democrats. But, you know, you do have to keep these things in mind when you read, because I think these are moral books. I think these are books written with a moral in mind. I don't think it's just a pure contest of who's the hardest man or woman. You know, I don't think that's true at all. I think that's transparently untrue. You know, so that it's very difficult to say.
Yeah, I'd say we always
how to react to these things.
We always have a thin red line when we are talking about the 21st century values in fantasy, because you can go wrong in either direction. You can go very wrong if you expect these values that we treasure to be brought up in these books and in these stories. But on the other hand, we can also come into serious trouble if we totally neglect that we have these values, and that our own fantasies and our own wishes and dreams should be measured to these values. That is why I find it so unsettling when people like Tywin Lannister, or when people think that the Greyjoys are great people, or something like that. But on the other hand, fantasy stories that are too rooted in 21st century values simply suck. There was this movie I watched 1 or 2 months ago, Ironclad, which takes place in medieval England, and there is a castle besieged. I don't know if you know it. It has great actors, and it is rooted firmly in historical events, but the movie is a catastrophe, because they have characters in there that clearly value 21st century values. For example, you have a woman in there that is so much emancipated that you wouldn't guess that women should be in any case oppressed or not be equal to other people in this time. And it totally feels out of character. It destroys everything that the story wants to do. And you have this in many fantasy books too. You have people rooting for a kind of primitive democracy or women's rights or stuff like that where it simply doesn't belong. And you have to find a balance between these two things. And if you don't accept, for example, that the Blackfish or Tywin Lannister are very well-written characters that fit perfectly into the world that is created by George R. R. Martin, then you can't value what he has done. But we are not allowed to make the mistake, we shouldn't make the mistake of applying the values and circumstances of the world that he has created to our own. And this is really not easy. And it doesn't allow for an easy answer to the question whether we should apply the values or not. We have to be a bit schizophrenic about it. You know what I mean?
Yes, yeah. The writing that I've done on the Song of Ice and Fire, you know, has dealt with these issues fairly directly, and I've come in for some criticism about people saying, like, oh, well, you really shouldn't, you know, you're reading too much into it, you know, that these aren't books about feminism, these aren't books about social justice, you know, why are you even bringing these things up? And it's like, well, no, you're right, they're not about those things. And the nature of the society that they chronicle is such that those things will never really come about in a form that you and I would recognize and support. And that's true of really any fantasy. You know, I mean, we've rejected, you know, being ruled by kings, but we still read books and enjoy books in which we root for kings, you know, and at no point do we expect Aragorn to institute electoral reforms and, you know, have direct democracy or anything like that. But we still root for Aragorn, even though that we know on some level that the society ruled by Aragorn is not the ideal compared to, you know, a contemporary democracy, which itself is not ideal, but that's, you know, it's closer to, it's better than a monarchy, you know, where one man decides who lives and who dies, essentially. You know, and in less sort of frivolous cases, you know, in issues there where here in America, at least, these are still things that are being debated pretty hotly. You know, I oppose the death penalty, but at the same time, I find myself cheering when Jon Snow orders the execution, or and conducts the execution of Janos Slynt, cuts his head off himself. Now, if I knew someone, you know, if Barack Obama did that tomorrow, I wouldn't vote for the guy anymore.
Yeah,
you know?
Absolutely.
And the fact that he does support the death penalty is one of my least favorite things about him. But you know, it's a fantasy, and so we accept certain aspects of what a fantasy is. But Martin is, you know, as all of us who read these books know, and is one of the selling points, is a more sophisticated writer, or is writing a more sophisticated fantasy than the traditional epic fantasy. And one of the characteristics of that is addressing these issues more directly, addressing what just how rotten life really was under these systems. It wasn't, you know, here's the White Tower with the good king, and then occasionally there's a Dark Lord they have to fight, but people are basically fine. You know, people are not basically fine under the system. You know, even under good-hearted, decent people, or, you know, people who take a real hands-off approach to their small folk, you know, the small folk still have a really tough life. Women have an incredibly difficult life, an incredibly prescribed life in terms of what they're able to do, what they're able to aspire to, how they're treated, and how they're left at the mercy of, you know, the use of rape as a weapon of war. These are things that Martin brings up for a reason, and it's not just to be like, oh, it's not just his equivalent of throwing orcs in there. You know, if he wanted some cool violence, he could have orcs. He doesn't have orcs. He doesn't have orcs because he wants us to think about these things. He doesn't necessarily want us to reject the whole book because we either think, because of these aspects of society, he doesn't want us to think, oh, well, this is a terrible place, these people are all terrible, I'm not reading these anymore. And nor does he want us to sit around, I don't think he wants us to sit around finding allegories and like, oh, well, this is the Iraq invasion, and this is, you know, and things of that nature. But they're there to be thought about. They're there to be discussed. They're not there just as window dressing, or just as an unusual way of having trolls or orcs or, you know, beholders or whatever. They're there because they're aspects of human behavior that we're meant to consider and evaluate. And that's part of what makes the books great, you know. And you're right, it's a fine line between contemplating our values and sort of judging the books based on how they reflect those values or don't reflect those values, or at the same time rejecting our values entirely and just sinking into this world and becoming one of these might makes right assholes.
Yeah. It is this, you shouldn't try to read specific things into it. I always was rooting for Tolkien when he rejected the notions that the Lord of the Rings is in some way about World War II or stuff like
right.
that. Because even if it was, that is not the way in which you should read the story. It's a bit like The Wizard of Oz, which was, I believe, written about the Great Depression, but nobody reads it like that anymore. But the book is still great in its own right. And it would be the same with Lord of the Rings or Song of Ice and Fire. It is just, you find stuff in there that is meaningful, of which, if you think about it, can tell you things about the human soul, about yourself, and brings up questions about how would you behave, what is your own life about. All these things are in there, great character issues, and that is new to the genre of fantasy,
yeah.
for sure.
Yeah.
And if we go at it with our 21st century attitudes and think about whether it would be good or not, we are also posing questions to ourselves. I mean, it is not chance that we bring up contemporary issues all the time, comparing this to elections of Obama or stuff like that, because it is always there in the subtext if we are willing to think about it.
Right. And, you know, I just think that it demands being thought about, you know, because, you know, just also from the perspective of having a pleasurable reading experience, it's much deeper and much richer and much more provocative and much more enjoyable for me to be thinking about these things instead of to just dismiss it all and not have hour-long Skype conversations with someone I met over the internet who lives in Germany about these things, you know? This has enhanced my reading experience. So just, you know, if you want to look at it from that perspective too, you know, there's a reason why we can have these discussions, you know, and it's because of that sort of frisson between ourselves as people of the 21st century,
yeah.
and this society written about by a 21st century person, bringing all his own ideas and values to the table as he writes, but chronicling this very problematic society, this medieval style society. It's that conflict between those two things that has created such a rich text for us to talk about.
Yeah, I also want to emphasize that I know about the fact that the Westerosi society is like it is and how the characters fit into it. I never doubt that these characters do what is required of them and what is perceived as right, as by many of their contemporaries. It is just that I also want to bring this 21st century attitude to, in addition to us as readers understanding what the characters are about.
Right.
And one should not meddle these two things. That's one of the difficulties when you approach the subject. And I think there have been some misunderstandings in the past about that and about our intentions about it. So I just wanted to clear that once again.
Good idea. Well, that may be all. I think that's probably all the time I have for the discussion today.
Okay.
If this is an all right time to hang it up.
Yeah, I think so. We have one issue left, but that will be a more big one, I think, because we have many questions to evolve around it. Just as a teaser, I think we can throw out it is religious fundamentalism, and there will be serious questions to be discussed about religion and the rise of politics and religion in Westeros over the course of A Feast for Crows and A Dance with Dragons. So stay tuned for the next time, and it was a pleasure.
Likewise, and I'm really excited to continue.
Okay, then I wish you a nice day, a good New Year's Eve, and the same thing to our listeners.
Thank you, everybody. Thanks for listening.